Now, acclaimed author Colm Keane, who joins us on the line now, returns to one of his favourite subjects this month with the release of his third book on the subject of Padre Pio, Irish Encounters with the Saint. Good morning, Colm.
Good morning, Marissa.
How are you today?
Not too bad. Wet and windy where I am, but still thriving.
Wet and windy here too. You just said it's the first official day of winter. Anyway, you're back writing about Padre Pio for the third time.
I am, yeah. I wrote the first book for me about Padre Pio 10 years ago, and it was a big success. It was a number one bestseller. I wrote another one 4 years ago. And each of those books, I gave the money, the proceeds, to the Capuchin Day Centre for the Homeless in Dublin. And about 10 months ago, well, in fact, about a year ago, I got a chance phone call from Brother Kevin. It was actually a mistaken call, and we got chatting about the homeless, dreadful crisis there. And I finally said to him, you know, I got so down about it, I said, look, I'll do a third book on Padre Pio, and the proceeds are yours, and here it is.
And I do think that Padre Pio would very much approve of that. Now, like a lot of Irish people, Colm, Padre Pio is somebody that you seem to have a great affinity with.
Irish people, yeah, always had a great affinity with him, right from the very beginning. I've often wondered about that, Marissa, as to really why. And, you know, I think part of it was, even back, say, in the 1940s, 50s, and into the 60s, that Irish Catholicism was pretty austere. You know, it was fairly severe. And along came this man who was producing miracles and cures and bilocating, reading people's minds. It was really exciting, and they took to that very much. They also, I think, took to the man. You know, he was a very granddad looking man. He was a bit like your own granddad, very avuncular and very kind. And people, you know, are not stupid. They could see that he was real. It wasn't like he was going on world tours or anything like that. He stayed in San Giovanni. They could see the reality and the sincerity of the man, and they travelled to him and to the friars in droves from Ireland, and then subsequently over the years.
Indeed. And you know, he had that charisma. He was also, you know, something of a maverick. And, you know, it comes across in the book as well that he wasn't always approved of by the Catholic Church. Indeed, there was a period there where he was very much ostracised.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There were a lot of reasons for that. Once the reports came out for the, you know, that miracles were taking place, local congregations flooded up to San Giovanni, to the friary, to his masses, and of course they started deserting the secular churches. The money, of course, also started going up to the friary, and the local priests weren't happy about that. And the local archbishop, who was quite an unsavoury man at the time, long dead, Archbishop Gagliardi, Pasquale Gagliardi, he started making allegations to Rome. You know, he said that he wore perfume, which, by the way, was not utterly untrue, because there was this scent of perfume from his blood and from him. But then, of course, he started saying when he wore makeup, which was rubbish, and he said that he consorted with women, which, by the way, again, wasn't totally untrue, because he did talk to women. They came with their problems, but then, of course, he was saying he was having an affair with women. And being an archbishop, he was believed. And these restrictions were imposed on him. You know, he wasn't allowed to say public masses, hear public confessions, meet with his devotees, or reveal the stigmata. And that continued right over the decades, up to actually 1963, when it was Pope Paul VI finally relieved them for once and for all.
Right, and I presume there that allegation he was wearing makeup, was he implying that he, in fact, there was no stigmata, that the, you know, these five wounds were some kind of special effects?
Yeah, and that was alleged from the beginning. First of all, that it was a big hoax and just a money-making racket. What's very interesting is one of the first people to investigate that in 1920. I mean, the stigmata only appeared in 1918, the news came out in 1919, and the Vatican sent their first investigator, Dr. Pascal Robinson, who came from Dublin, and he was a high-flying Vatican diplomat, a Franciscan, very well educated, very bright man, and from the very beginning he concluded that the wounds were real, that they were, you know, basically a bit like a coin, the size of a coin, and they oozed blood. They lost about a cupful of blood every day. The blood would congeal, it would crust, it would dig into the flesh, cause severe pain, and the five wounds on the hands, the feet and the side were adjudged by him to be real. And the other investigators, a Dr. Festa, Dr. Bignamy, a Dr. Romanelli, they all concluded exactly the same. So the makeup thing was rubbish. I mean, whatever the causes of the wounds, they were real.
Now, you mentioned there 1918, and you give a very graphic description in the book of what actually happened then, and, you know, how these stigmata come about. And again, you know, a lot of people would have, particularly now in the modern age, would probably have great difficulty in, you know, comprehending that this could happen.
You're right. I'll give you the description that he gave. He only described it on three occasions in his life. It was written down. And it was on that date, 20th of September 1918. He had finished his mass in the morning, and he had a tradition, you might call it, of winding down after mass. You know, he would say prayers of thanksgiving, and he would do it up in the choir loft of the chapel at the friary. And this was September. The light was fading a little bit. We were moving into autumn. It was about 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning. And he said he was kneeling there in prayer, and across him was a crucifix with the crucified Christ and the five wounds. And he said suddenly from the wounds there emanated these shards of light, these like bolts of lightning that came right towards him and stabbed him in the hands and the feet, not in the side at that occasion. That had happened slightly beforehand. He immediately started bleeding. He fell to the ground. He became semi-comatose, extreme pain, and eventually dragged himself together and made it back to the cell, and then eventually told his superior. But even though it's hard to grasp that something like that would happen, it was established that they were for real. And the one little point I would make, Marissa, is that people might have said, oh, this was because he was so devout, it was, you know, mind over matter. Padre Pio always had a great answer to that, to anybody who raised that point. He would say to the people, you know what you should do is go out to a field, find a field with a bull in it, don't go into the field, the bull might attack you, lean on the fence, look over, look in, stare at the bull, concentrate as hard as you can for as long as you can, and then when you're finished, walk away, put your hands up to your head and see if you've developed horns. I think it's a very good analogy as to how it was a little bit more than just pure concentration.
Absolutely, but also then came, you know, the miracles, and there were miracles while Padre Pio was still alive, before he was canonized.
Yeah, they were straight away. Right after 1918, the very first two miracles, one was a person, a soldier who had survived World War One. He had a gangrenous foot, and his leg was due for amputation, and he said that, well, more than said, he never required the amputation. His foot and his leg, they were healed. And there was a blind man from the local village who had his sight restored. And then there was a wonderful story which I should tell you about, very real story. It's really accredited, it's been investigated. A young girl called Gemma Di Giorgi, and she was born with no pupils in her eyes. She simply couldn't see, and the family were told she'd never see for the rest of her life. Her granny, who was a devotee of Padre Pio, when the child was 7, she said, "I've had enough of this. I'm bringing Gemma to meet Padre Pio." She went to the child chapel in the way that Padre Pio would do it. You know, he could read situations. He came down, came straight up to Gemma, looked at her. It's very moving, actually, this story, in a way. Simply put his hand on her head and said, "Good girl, Gemma." And he added, "May the Lord be with you." And from then on, Gemma could see. Now, she never developed pupils in her eyes. Many, many experts investigated this, and they could never credit or understand how she could see from then on.
Extraordinary. Also extraordinary is this powers of bilocation with which Padre Pio was invested, Colin.
Yeah, the bilocation thing was really quite remarkable. You know, the ability to be in two places, at least two, at the same time. There was a great story told by a friar. Again, it was written down by this other friar. In the friary, they would have these entertainments for the friars. Initially, there were only seven friars there, and then it grew bit by bit. And this night they had an entertainment, and Padre Pio, he was sitting there enjoying the first half, and then at the intermission, this other friar spotted that he was gone into a kind of a trance, semi-comatose, semi-catatonic kind of state, not uncommon for him. It was a time where they felt that he was in communion with something supernatural. And then in the second half, he came back to life again and watched the show. The next day, this other friar had to visit a family in San Giovanni, and there was somebody sick there. And when he arrived at the door, the people were quite happy, and they said, "It's okay, you know, we had a visit last night." And he said, "But we had an entertainment in the friary last night. Nobody was out." And they said, "Oh, yes." And he said, "Well, who?" And they said, "Well, Padre Pio." And he immediately knew Padre Pio had gone nowhere, but he knew the answer to when he asked the next question. He said, "What time was he here?" And it was exactly the time that he went into that state in the friary. You might disbelieve it, but there are so many stories like that, including from Ireland, involving this sort of bilocation.
Indeed, and there are so many stories in your book, The Irish Encounters with the Saints. Now, what you've done is you've taken Irish people or people with an Irish connection and told their story that's connected to Padre Pio, and you've done it in three sections there. You have the early years, the middle years, and then his final last few years. And such interesting. I mean, the different people that encounter him have a different relationship and a different story to tell about Padre Pio.
Yeah, everybody has a story. That's one of the, I suppose, in a way, the great things about the book, but it's one of the great things about the Padre Pio saga, is that people's interactions were also interesting and also different. I'll give you one little brief one here. It's a little bit of a scary story in a way, and it concerns Jim Connolly and Patricia, his wife. They come from the Fermanagh Roscommon area, not terribly far from where you are. And Jim, when he was young, you know, when he was in his early 20s, he had harboured the idea of becoming a priest, and he knew Latin, he knew a little bit of Italian, he spent time in Italy, and he went to confession with Padre Pio, and during confession, Padre Pio said to him, "You're going to die young." And Padre Pio also put his hand on Jim's head, and some of the blood from the hand congealed onto a lock of hair, which Jim took off, put in an amulet, and kept it around his neck for the rest of his short life. Now, he never became a priest. He got married to Patricia. They had a child called Pio Emmanuel. He was obsessed, really, by Padre Pio for the rest of his days. They moved to England, but he would come back to Ireland. He was a good footballer, and he would come back to play football, and then go back to England again, do it for a weekend. And one weekend when he was over, he was in a car crash, and he was in a coma. His mum looked after him. Patricia was minding the kids. She was working in England as well, and she'd come over and back as much as she could. And then he died. Now, he died only at the age of 33, but also, in a rather strange way, he died on the 23rd of September, which is the same date that Padre Pio died, not the same year now, same date, and he died at 2:30 in the morning, the same time as Padre Pio died. And it's something that has really stricken Patricia for the rest of her days. Every time I've spoken to her, she's really disturbed by that story and trying to understand what it means. There are loads of stories like that, and all in the book.
All in the book. Now, you mentioned the confessional there, and he wasn't a big fan, Padre Pio, of Mary Quant and her miniskirt, and indeed he had very strict regulations on the inchage of women's skirts before they'd be permitted into that confessional.
Yeah, yeah, it had to be the skirt had to be below 8 inches below the knee, or otherwise you'd be turfed out of the confessional. And you know, if you had bare arms or a low-cut dress, or if you wore a pantsuit, he didn't like them either. It had to be really formal wear. You've got to remember, the miniskirt came in really in the mid-60s, around 64, 65, and Padre Pio was in his late 70s, so he was a man of his times, and the times weren't the 60s, but there was another rule up, actually, saying that women were not to change or exchange skirts in the church. And a guy called John McCaffrey, who was a good friend of Padre Pio, came from Donegal, and he found out the reason for that, that one day Padre Pio was in the confessional, he could see out, and he saw this woman who had a miniskirt on, and she was changing the skirt with the woman beside her, because she knew there were going to be thunderbolts when she went into Padre Pio. And she went in, and he was, as you know, the layout and confession, dealing with the person on the left. She was in on the right, and then he turned to the right. He slammed open the shutter and said to her, well, what are we doing? Preparing for the circus, and slammed it shut again. So off she went. No confession, no absolution. So you had to take great care if you were a woman.
Well, he was, though, Colm, and like all Italians, certainly the majority of them, he was a big fan of football.
Yeah, I was intrigued by that. I remember 10 years ago I met Father Ermelindo di Capua, who came to Ireland a number of times, and he had worked with Padre Pio, became a real close friend of his, knew him intimately. And the first question I asked him, I mean, I love football myself, and I said to him, look, given that he was Italian, Padre Pio must have been into soccer, into football. And I think he was relieved with the question, that it wasn't a first question about how holy he was or the miracles or whatever. And we got into a real long conversation, and it turned out he was a big fan of, you know, the local team called Foggia, and also of Inter Milan. And Inter Milan were a wonderful team at the time, and they seldom played Foggia, but there was one occasion for a couple of years that Foggia were up in Serie A. And there's a great little story, actually, that Inter Milan were brought up by their manager up to meet Padre Pio. They came up to Foggia, and he brought some of the players up to meet Padre Pio. And at the end, he said to Padre Pio, almost like teasingly and trying to figure out, you know, I hope we're going to win the match tomorrow. And there was no hope that they were going to lose it, because Foggia were so brutal, they were so bad. And Padre Pio immediately replied, and he said, no, you will lose the match tomorrow, but you will win the Scudetto. In other words, you will win the league. And anybody who's got YouTube, you could see the highlights there right now. You'll see that Foggia went into a 2-0 lead. Milan, Inter Milan came back 2-2. And Foggia then scored towards the end of the 1-3-2. And Milan did go on and win the league. So he had this ability to be able to predict. And in this case, it was almost predicting the impossible, because really, Foggia were not due to win that match.
Okay. Well, I'm just wondering, I'm talking about predicting the impossible and all the Irish connections with Padre Pio, is there anything you could do for the Irish soccer team?
Yeah, especially maybe to get them to play good football.
Listen, there's plenty more fascinating stories like that in your book column. It's available now, published by Capel Island. And as you mentioned at the beginning, all of the proceeds from the book, Padre Pio, Irish Encounters with the Saint, are going to the Capuchin Day Centre for the Homeless in Dublin. Colm, as always, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you, Marissa, and a pleasure to talk to you as well.